Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast of the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. I'm David Bowes, your host. February 12th is Darwin Day, the birth date of Charles Darwin, but also the birth date of Abraham Lincoln. Professor Stephen Fuller has written a play, Darwin and Lincoln, One Night Only, to explore the worldview and philosophy of both men and to investigate how they might perceive advances in the modern world. I was able to speak with Professor Fuller at length about the issues that are raised in his play. Lincoln in the play observes that it's not a question of science to determine research priorities, but a question of politics. What was he getting at there, and how are research priorities set, who decides, and what is outside money done to research?
Well, see, okay, this is a really mixed bag, too. I would say that, you know, Lincoln, as he's portrayed in the play, is absolutely right, because there's a sense in which science can be moving in many different directions at once. So, for example, if, let's say, you believe that we should be thinking about humanity sort of in the manner of the way we tend a garden, where we actually do worry about weeds in the garden. I mean, if you really take that idea literally, you could certainly develop a science that could do that very effectively, okay? And it would be this very negative eugenics kind of science, and we've seen the consequences of that in the 20th century. You see, so there's a sense in which you make one political choice, and you can certainly find the science you need for that, and the science can work very effectively. So there's a sense in which the politics at the outset is very important. What kinds of value, what kind of a world do you want to live in? And once you get clear about that, then it becomes clear what sorts of science you ought to support and not support. Now, I think the thing that needs to be said about private money is that, in fact, private funding for science has been the dominant mode until, I would say, the second half of the 20th century. And I think people need to realize that while you do have precedents, let's say in Germany in particular, where you have strong national initiatives to develop scientific areas as part of nation building, for the most part, national investment in science usually has been very closely tied to military efforts, which is to say, when a nation is at war, all the scientists work together to improve things, and then when the war is over, they go back to where they were before. Now, often a lot of innovations come from that. There's no doubt about it. A lot of medical research, for example, comes from concerns about trying to make sure soldiers don't get ill, or if they do get ill, they get well quickly, and so forth. So I don't want to say that there hasn't been really strong state investment in science, but in terms of continuous state investment in science, of the sort that we're sort of used to in the United States from the National Science Foundation, that is only something from the end of World War II. Prior to that point, major sustained funding for science came from private foundations. In the United States, the Rockefeller Foundation probably being the most important one, and in Britain we have several major medical charities like the Wellcome Trust and the Nuffield Trust that have been very continuous supporters of scientific research. But of course, what that means then is that the science that is promoted is kind of, you might say, in the image and likeness of the benefactor, right? So Rockefeller, for example, was very interested in people, in sort of an improved human race, you might say, kind of enhanced human beings who could work more productively and would be able to basically produce more wealth for America. That was always the bottom line for him. And so all sorts of medical research got funded, and a lot of it, of course, on both sides of the Atlantic, was very instrumental in the development of molecular biology. And ultimately, when the structure of DNA was discovered in 1953, it was on the back of Rockefeller money, not the back of money from Harvard University. So I do think that there is that kind of history, and it's been very important history, but one also always has to see the funder always ends up having a strong steer on where the science goes.
In your play, in a related question, Darwin was horrified to learn that in recent years we've mimicked natural selection in the lab, cracked the genetic code, manufactured evolution by way of genetic engineering, and now sell a scientific vision of the world to the public on TV by the likes of Richard Dawkins and other science popularizers. Why would someone like Darwin worry so much about how science and society have turned out? Is he concerned about the autonomy of science? Is he worried about the way the fruits of science have been used to garner unearned social deference to scientific-sounding pronouncements? What is your thought?
No, actually, I don't think it's any of that. I think it's more that he thinks that this kind of, you might say, blind faith in science is very dangerous. Okay, Darwin had a very humble view of science. In fact, the whole point about natural selection is Darwin's supposed discovery of natural selection was designed, you might say, to make human beings humble that they cannot adopt the kind of Newton's God's point of view to understand how nature works. That, in fact, the processes are ones that are basically blind to human interest and human purposes. They are ones that have unfolded for many millions, maybe even billions of years, which is to say in a time scale that's completely irrelevant to the human condition, where human beings are just these little specks. And so from Darwin's standpoint, there is no empirical grounds for human beings to think that they could ever get a sufficiently comprehensive grasp of how the nature of life works to be able to do something like create life in the lab, let alone talk about a genetic code which makes it look like life is language. Darwin, I don't think, believed any of that stuff. And I think if you were to tell Darwin all of this stuff that's taken place, especially since the discovery of the double helix structure of DNA, I think Darwin would just think this is a kind of high-tech theology. And I think this is the thing, you know, from the standpoint of intelligent design theory, I think it's something that needs to be kind of registered in the right way. Because I think Stephen Meyer made a really, it was really very smart of him to hone in on the developments in molecular biology as a really decisive refutation of the kind of attitude toward science that Darwin had. Because Darwin would never have anticipated that there would be a genetic code, because he basically believed that life was dumb, right? Life was dumb. It was blind. It was dumb. Right. It didn't have a language that you could decipher and then make something out of it. Okay, that's a real big difference in sensibility about science. But then that raises the issue, and this is where I think intelligent design people need to be kind of, you might say, open about, is that, look, molecular biology gives us biotechnology. Biotechnology puts us back in the doorstep of eugenics. Okay, the people who believe in eugenics also believe that life had a code. They could be deciphered. It could be rearranged. You see, I mean, in a sense, the intelligent design movement feeds back into this kind of very strong kind of view about science being able to reconstruct the world. And I think this is the sort of thing that Darwin would recoil from, because Darwin did not believe that science could give human beings this kind of overarching power over nature.
Yeah, in the play you wrote that Darwin disliked the Newtonian mechanical view of the natural world where man would control everything here.
That's right.
What did Darwin have at stake there? Why did he so dislike the idea that everything would boil down to physics?
Look at it this way. The issue is kind of less about the discipline of physics and more about the attitude with which Newton did science. If you look at Darwin, right, how did Darwin do science? Darwin starts with the field. He goes in the field, he looks at the animals and the plants and all the rest of it, and then he kind of makes inferences about how the world must have developed. So he, as it were, reasons backward. You know, and he says, well, look at, you could see that rocks are eroding from the weather. You could see some small changes in organisms. Now imagine this whole process going on for billions and billions of years, and then you can then reason your way back to the primordial soup. Okay, this is kind of the way Darwin operates. Newton does it the exact opposite. Newton basically thinks that he can, as it were, reverse engineer creation. So Newton starts from the top. Newton says, here's the world as it presents itself to me. It's this very rational ordered thing, according to Newton. Now, what would be the simplest way to come up with this? Because that's probably what God did. And so Newton comes up with three laws in the principle of gravitation, basically. So Newton basically comes up with a simulation in his laws of physics. It's basically a kind of mathematical simulation of how God created the universe. Now, Darwin thought you could not get into that point of view, that that was just fiction. Darwin thought that what you had to do was basically reason backward empirically. So Newton, you know, might say, had a very deductive view of science, whereas Darwin has a very inductive view of science. And I think that's a real radical difference in scientific orientation. And I think basically, Darwin thought that Newton's view only worked in a very restricted realm, right? Namely, if you're talking about Earth and planets, and you're just talking about mechanical physical motion, but it could not be used to understand the nature of life itself.
Yeah, in the play, Darwin's anxious to avoid allowing natural selection to turn into another name for God or turn into a new kind of God.
Exactly.
And what did you mean by that, and how does Darwin's understanding of evolution maybe differ from how it's more commonly understood today?
Here's the thing, right? Darwin's theory of natural selection comes from Thomas Malthus. And Thomas Malthus is a dissenting Christian preacher who's known nowadays primarily as a political economist, and wrote this very famous essay on population, which basically tried to come up with a mathematically definable law about why it is, well, basically, it was an argument for why you'll never be able to feed everybody, that there's a kind of law of nature whereby there will always be more people than the food available to feed them and to sustain them. And Malthus's point was that this was actually kind of good, because what it meant was that the only people who survived were the ones who were fit to survive. Especially if you're looking at the sorts of populations where you have multiple children, they tend to be from impoverished backgrounds, and there's a sense in which those people might as well die because they're not actually going to be very productive for society as a whole. So the people who end up dying are the ones who ought to be dying if you look at the full range of people available. So Malthus uses this as kind of an argument of God's invisible hand, you might say. Malthus is basically, his version of natural selection is a kind of theory of divine agency. Now, Darwin actually bought the view in the sense that Darwin believed that, yes, there is this population pressure issue, and that there is this kind of constant mass extinction taking place that never seems to go away. And this is not just about human beings, but this could be generalized to nature as a whole. But the cost of this view, according to Darwin, is that you can't imagine any sensible God doing this. Right? Any God who would do something like this would be excessively cruel, because basically it would be a God that enables all sorts of beings to come into existence just to get rid of them.
Right.
And so on that basis, Darwin bought the natural selection, but he said it had nothing to do with God. And in fact, it was, if this is the way the world works, if it works through natural selection, as Malthus was suggesting, then that's an argument against God's existence, not the proof of how God works. You see the difference? Just to add one more point, William Paley, who is the person from whom Darwin learned about natural theology when he was at Cambridge, Paley endorsed Malthus, okay? And I think this is an important point. Paley was willing to grant that this might be how God works, that God works in a way that might seem very morally offensive to human beings, but then there's no reason to think that everything that God does has to meet with humans' moral approval. But Darwin's own take on this was, he's not going to believe in a God like that. Darwin basically left the church on that.
So did Darwin see signs of purpose anywhere in the natural world, or did he want the language of purpose to die out?
He thought the language of purpose should just die out. Darwin did, you know, you might say he resorted to purpose language, but not because he wanted to. I think Darwin was very much in the spirit of saying that we live in a purposeless universe.
Toward the end, you have Lincoln suggesting that modern science has made even open public theological discussion of life's meaning respectable again. What did you mean by that? How did that happen? And why would the talk of meaning and purpose in nature bother Darwin?
Because I think, in a way, it's a way of smuggling in a God that Darwin didn't believe existed. And also, insofar as human beings think of themselves as being created in the image and likeness of this God, then human beings will start having these very ambitious purposes, right? They want to reconstruct the world in various ways. And Darwin believed that all of this purpose stuff, especially when it's, you know, with a capital P, purpose, ends up leading to endless misery. Because we don't have that kind of power, we don't have that kind of knowledge. What we do have power and knowledge over is perhaps our immediate environments, the things that are necessary for us to survive as populations in particular places at particular times, yes, but not these kind of overarching world-transforming purposes that are normally associated with the meaning of life, especially in the theological tradition, but also in certain kinds of secular notions of progress as well. Darwin is against all of that stuff. Now, Lincoln, the point about Lincoln, what he's saying in the play, is that when you start to take seriously, so here's Lincoln reflecting on what has happened in the last 200 years, so he hears about all this stuff about the genetic code and about the fact that we understand how life works in very intricate detail and how we're able to even intervene in life processes at all kinds of levels and maybe even manufacture life to a certain extent. Well, those capacities, those powers, force moral questions on us. So in other words, once we gain all of this capacity to transform the genome, then you immediately have on the table moral and political questions. Because the science itself is not going to tell you what you should do with that power. You see, and I think that's where Lincoln is coming from here, that there's a sense in which science opens up opportunities for moral and political discourse to happen.
Would a world devoid of purpose in nature be morally impoverished? Would that remove the need for morality?
Of course. I mean, I think if you really get rid of meaning and purpose from nature in the manner that Darwin suggested, then your morality just becomes the Epicurean one of the minimization of pain. That becomes kind of your baseline notion. And so what you end up having is a concern for living in equilibrium with your environment. I mean, I think a lot of the ecologists, especially the people who, in a sense, want to downsize industrial capacity, downsize science, I think that is kind of in the spirit of what Darwin was after in the end.
Obviously, you're dealing with a host of issues, very important issues in the play, Lincoln Darwin, One Night Only. What do you hope when audience members are walking out, what do you hope they're talking about and taking with them?
Well, first of all, I think that in a sense, Darwin lived in a very different world from us. In a sense, that's the main point, given that the punchline is Darwin doesn't want to stay in the 21st century, whereas Lincoln does. Right? Darwin wants to go back to the 19th century. That Darwin's world is not our world. The popular view of Darwin is that he was this kind of uber scientist who, in a way, wanted to kind of impose science on the world, kind of in the way one thinks about Richard Dawkins today. But on the contrary, Darwin's view about natural selection as being the key to understanding the nature of life was part of a very kind of downsized and diminished view about what science can do for human beings and for the world. And as a result, he never anticipated the very profound moral and political questions that are on our doorstep because our scientific knowledge is so much more powerful than he ever thought. Okay? So in a sense, Darwin did not give enough credit to human beings. And in all kinds of ways, not only in terms of his theory, but in terms of what he thought the future would be. And so Darwin, as a figure, is not really mentally prepared to confront the kinds of challenges that come from, let's say, being able to reverse engineer the genome, to be able to enhance ourselves in various ways. All of these kinds of biotechnological issues that are going to become more and more important as the century moves on.
We hope you've enjoyed this discussion with Professor Stephen Fuller about his play, Lincoln and Darwin, One Night Only, and the issues and controversies that it explores. This podcast is ID the Future from the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. If you'd like to support the Center for Science and Culture, please go to idthefuture.com and click the yellow donate button. This podcast is copyright 2012, the Discovery Institute. All rights reserved.